Ridley Scott did a Christian film. He did Exodus.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
it still wasn't very good.
He should do another one called Ben-Hur.
It is the weekend, and that means new movies are out, which means only one thing. Welcome to John Serba Hates Your Favorite Movie.
I'm very excited about this. I think this will be fun. Or should I not be excited about it?
I would love it if you would be excited about it.
At least you'd be excited about something. So.
And now, John Serba Hates Your Favorite Movie.
Oh, and welcome to a slightly belated version of I Hate Your Favorite Movie, the podcast. I am John Serba, MLive, an advanced movie critic. I'm here with Eric Hultgren, as usual.
I was north of the wall, which is why we couldn't get this done, so I apologize. But
yeah, you were.
I'm back.
You were slaying White Walkers.
Yes, I'm back in Winterfell so we can record properly the podcast.
Did you bring back some dragon glass for me?
I did, just awesome. So you can protect yourself.
Awesome, thank you.
You're
thank
welcome.
You. I appreciate that. My family appreciates that. In case
I didn't bring enough for them, just for you.
Hey, I'll be the one defending that.
I'll make that decision, Eric, where the assets get distributed amongst my family.
We're going to talk about Finding Dory, which set some box office records over the weekend.
Oh, boy, did it. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big deal. I'm frankly not surprised. And later we'll get into Central Intelligence with Kevin Hart and Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Who's busy this year.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of irons in the fire.
Yeah, exactly. He does.
And my guess is not all of them are red hot.
Have any of
Sorry,
them
spoiler,
ever,
spoiler alert.
Have any of them ever been red hot?
Movie-wise?
Well, he's Fast and Furious.
Yeah, Fast and Furious. That's... But I mean, like, the things that he does on his own, no.
No. No, not at all. Not at all.
If it doesn't have Paul Walker or robotic Paul Walker or brother of Paul Walker, I think.
Or G.I. Joe.
Or G.I. Joe. Well, even that didn't really hold much water.
So, yeah, Finding Dory did $136 million. I'm always... I hate box office figures like that. Give me ticket sales numbers. You know, that's the big thing. Everybody speaks in terms of dollars. And I've been grinding this axe for a long time, frankly. But, you know, tell me how many people saw the movie, and that will impress me. Because you're like, oh, $136 million is the greatest opening for an animated film of all time. And fact of the matter is, are we factoring in inflation? We're comparing today's dollars to dollars from how many years ago, you know? So, how many people actually went to see the movie? I don't know. No one ever has that statistic.
Well, add in a couple more of John Serba variables, and this number becomes less and less interesting, right? That is, as you've been saying since we started this podcast, there's been nothing for families to watch for four months.
Sure, for sure.
So, yeah, of course it breaks a record. They've been waiting for 120 days to do anything. Like, yeah. They've been wandering around a theater for 4 months going, anything to watch? No? Okay, we'll just keep walking. Like, and then, there's a Pixar film. Everybody go! Because
yeah,
there's nothing
exactly,
to watch.
Exactly. And you have to take into account stuff like IMAX tickets.
Was this in IMAX?
Maybe not, but you know, sometimes
I wasn't questioning you. I was just asking.
Well, just in general, box office
sure
numbers are always inflated by IMAX tickets, which are $15. You know, $15 to $20. Quick, funny aside. I had a friend who was in L.A. working.
It is, in fact.
Oh yeah, yes. Yeah. So I knew it was on. I thought it was on some IMAX screens. Yep. I had a friend who was in L.A. and a basic evening. Weekend ticket in Los Angeles was $17.75.
Wow.
Yeah. And we're up to like $11 here in Grand Rapids. And IMAX is like 16 and or so, 15 or 16, depending on 3D or non-3D. There's a lot of factors involved in coming up with a box office number, but all anybody ever sees is the big one. $136 million.
It's easier for accountants to deal with, right? It cost us $3 to make. We made $136 million. Heretofore, success.
And you marketing people love this
kind
of stuff.
We love this math. It's so easy. We don't have to know anything.
It's easy to make a big splash with a big number.
Ooh, look at that. Well played. It's like you're a writer, professionally.
I am just drowning in the puns.
Okay, all right.
So
to,
yeah,
to the gills? Would you say that? No. Okay. All
right. Up to the gills in puns.
Okay. Here we go.
But yeah, finding I'm not surprised it was that popular, because not only were families just like dying in the desert trying to find something to go see, but Finding Nemo was a massive hit. Wasn't it the top grossing movie of 2003? Double check that figure, but I'm pretty sure that,
keep
that
going.
Was, it was
I'll
a
fact-check.
Huge hit. And that kind of nostalgia, I mean, kids who were 5 when it came out are now 18, and they're going to the theater too. I mean, I saw groups of teenagers and college age kids who were really amped to see Finding Dory, because Finding Nemo was such a huge part of their childhood.
It was the highest grossing animated film of all time, current to that time, 2003. Second highest grossing film of that year.
Okay, all right. What was? Oh, Star Wars? Star Wars?
It doesn't say in this article. You're making me do too much research on
it. No, well, talk to me. Screw Google. I think it's a good thing that so many people are seeing this movie. Not just because Pixar and Disney, Pixar is art and Disney is commerce, and they've got a wonderful relationship, you know, in the sense that Disney can sell, and Pixar has a product of substance.
And dude, I mean, like this, not to, you know, I don't know where we're going to go with this, but I mean, storytelling in this movie is like, high art. I mean, I thought this movie was just fantastic. And I think part of it was because I nerded out at the short, which I tend to do. That's usually my favorite part.
Yeah.
That Piper short, I thought was incredible. Like, visually was just
incredible. You know,
I mean, it's not like the most brilliant story, right? But visually, I was like, this is the most incredible thing I have seen ever.
It looked like Piper, just the as all Pixar films are, it's preceded by a short, and it's called Piper, and it's about sandpipers on a beach, and it looks like a nature documentary.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for just the slight,
there's one or two, and then other than that, you'd be all in, because like you see the sand, and you're like, is this real? Is this fake?
Yeah.
And then there's a couple where you're like, oh, okay, your eye and your brain figure it out, but then it goes right back to like, what's going on here?
I think it might be the most convincingly photorealistic animation ever. What took me out of that was the fact that the characters, the birds in the movie are, you know, have some human qualities, you know, that normal birds would not have. But it's just so,
yes.
It's so entirely, it's very slight, you know, it's so convincingly realistic. Just the way the surf looks and the camera movements on it, and the way it like the camera takes focus is like the camera is following a bird in the wild. It's really remarkably well made, and it's cute as hell.
It's really cute, but it's very rare for the amount of films. I don't see nearly as many as you do, but per the average person, I see a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's rare for me 1 or 2 seconds into something like that to be like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, wow, what is happening here?
Yeah. So you liked Finding Dory.
You know what? As we said last week, like, I was not a huge fan of Finding Nemo for whatever reason. Age, like, because it came out a little bit. I didn't have kids. I was kind of in between. It just didn't connect to me in the way that it does now. And maybe because I have kids, we didn't go with them yet. I was working when I did this. But I just thought her story seemed to me to be far more tragic and drew me in more in a way that Finding Nemo didn't at the time.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, this is, like, the first half hour of that movie I thought was like heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the movie kind of does what Pixar movies do. But I just thought this movie was operating on a really, really, really high level. I don't know where it would end up if you forced me to do the John Serba top 10 Pixar movies, but I thought it was really well done.
See, I think you actually liked it just a touch more than I did. And I loved it, frankly. Finding Nemo was almost a Bambi type throwback,
right?
You know,
yes.
Obviously with the death of the mother character at the very beginning of the film, Finding Dory is a completely different thing. And I think the subtext of this, and this is where Pixar is absolutely brilliant, and this is where Ellen DeGeneres is brilliant, Because I know you were, you had said before, she annoys me.
She did, in the first movie, I just didn't think the voice acting was there, but it was way different in this one. And I don't know, you know, what had changed, but I just thought the storytelling, I was all in.
Well, I think what happens is, in the first movie, Dory is a secondary character. She's a supporting character. And so by that token, the character is a little more one-dimensional, and I think DeGeneres plays a little more one-dimensional. I thought that one dimension was remarkable because it had that like real light comic touch to it, you know, where Dory doesn't realize she's being funny,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
She's just being herself.
Yep.
And Ellen DeGeneres really did that character a lot of justice. And in this time, it's you know, the big discussion coming out of the film is the fact that Dory has a disability. And a lot of the movie, you know, Marlon and Nemo are back, of course, and they're kind of helping her, and they as she quests for her parents. And Marlon is, you know, he's an older school kind of guy. He's voiced by Albert Brooks. How can he not be an older school kind of guy?
And it's still very Albert Brooks-esque.
Yeah, exactly. And he gets impatient with her, you know. And that's contrasted by flashbacks. You know, as Dory goes along, she's kind of starting to remember bits of her childhood and piecing it together as she's on her quest. This, like, really vague quest to just go somewhere and find where her parents are. And she's going kind of on a whim at times. I mean, does she trust her own memory? She has to. She has no choice. She's got to try something. What is she questing after? She doesn't even really know. That's the fascinating thing about this character. She can't really remember it. Just bits and pieces that are finally starting to come together. And the most heartbreaking stuff in this movie is when, you know, the events prior to finding Nemo.
Yes.
Where she is just, have you seen a family? She knows she's missing her family, but she doesn't know who they are. She can't even describe to other fish in the sea what her family looked like. That is heartbreaking.
Uh-huh.
That is really remarkable. And so getting back to the big conversation coming out of it is, you know, this is like has a character with a serious disability, a real life disability that real people have, not just a talking fish in a movie. Has this type of character had this big of an audience, this much of this large of a reach, where this could be, frankly, an educational moment for young people and older people who maybe don't understand how to deal with people with disabilities in that sense. And you know, as the movie goes along, you get the sense that her memory is like a muscle, and it needs to be exercised built up.
Yep.
And you get that sense at the end of the movie where I don't pretend to know a whole lot about short-term memory loss like that, chronic short-term memory loss, or how it works, or what people do to cope with it beyond Memento tattooing things on him so he remembers.
Yes. This show took an odd turn.
Well, I had seen another podcast out there was actually
going to compare
Memento and Finding Dory, which I thought was ingenious. And the thought crossed my mind while I was watching this film too, frankly. But, you know, I think there is a big discussion that this movie is going to open. And how many times does that happen during a blockbuster-laden summer? It's really quite a remarkable thing. It's quite a remarkable thing.
And then, of course, there's the, you know, to go a couple layers back up to the more mass appeal stuff, there's some of the stuff that I thought was just wonderful was I thought Ed O'Neill's character was really great. Ty Burrell was kind of funny, but I was amazed at, and I don't know the technical way to describe this, but the way that they played with light between being underwater and being above water, where it looked pseudo real when they come above above the ocean, I thought that stuff was super interesting. And of course, it ends up taking place, which would be essentially the Monterey Bay Aquarium is kind of where they are. And I've been there, and I've been, you know, I've been underwater. And like, so to see the way that they were able to capture how muddy and kelpy that it was just magnificent, the scenery and the amount of detail that goes into the scenery that most people who hadn't been there wouldn't care about how different it needed to look from the first movie to the second movie. But the stuff that they were doing in and around the scenes themselves, I thought was just incredible.
Yeah. The kelp forest.
Yes.
Like the dark shadows of that kelp forest. Kind of scary.
Sure.
You know, in those flashbacks where Dory is lost, she ends up going back to those. You can't imagine that would be easy for someone. You know, that's a dark, scary, lonely place. And there's stuff out there that wants to eat you.
Yep. that likes to hide in dark, scary places like
that. And I really like the new supporting characters. You mentioned Ty Burrell. He plays a beluga whale who's like struggling with his echolocation skills. And of course, he learns how to use them when he needs them the most. And it was Caitlin Olsen who plays the nearsighted whale shark.
Destiny.
And Ed O'Neill is the octopus who's missing a tentacle, so he's a septopus. And he's this like typical kind of crank. I thought the way they animated that octopus and what he does, and he's changing colors and he's going all over. There's just so many clever flourishes in this. The way he carries Dory around in a coffee pot, which, by the way, I was at Toys R Us over the weekend and there is a toy coffee pot with a Dory in it.
Of course there is.
Of course. How did I not buy it was the question. Really remarkable stuff. But like going back to that style of animation, that was one of the big like steps forward that Finding Nemo did. And I don't know if you remember this, is when this was a couple of years after Monsters Incorporated, where, oh my gosh, look at Sully's hair.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe it. Like every hair has three animators or whatever working on it.
Yes.
And then the next step was Finding Nemo, where you don't really realize it. Majority of the movie takes place underwater. And then when, boop, it comes up to the surface, and there's that whole sequence in Australia where the fish are in the aquarium. And all of a sudden, there's that murk is gone. And it's just this crystal clear, bright quality to it. And, you know, they made the ocean look completely realistic because of that like haze. You are underwater. There, the light hits everything differently. It's just eye popping. And this plays with it even more because you've got aquariums, you've got the deep ocean, you have the shallows, you have a number of different settings that it can play with. And I don't mean to get too geeky about this, but it's a marvel.
Well, it's not only a marvel, but when you look at the jump from Good Dinosaur to this, it's a huge, and Good Dinosaur was amazing.
Gorgeous.
In its scenery, right? But even now there's another jump, and that's one movie apart, which is, I think, I know we're getting super nerdy, but like that's the stuff in the animation world, and I'm like, this is just amazing stuff that they're making right now.
Well, and frankly, it had kind of plateaued for a while, because as good as, you know, Up, or the Toy Story movies are, those were more sophisticated steps forward in like storytelling.
Sure, yeah.
You know, writing characters, things like that. Which isn't to downplay Finding Dory's writing at all. Animation had kind of plateaued.
Yeah, because Up was trying to figure out how to do a miscarriage and dying of cancer all in 3 minutes, and that was very difficult to do while trying to advance.
Yeah, exactly.
Animation.
Exactly. Let's not talk about that. You're gonna make me blubber. I put together. You'll find this on the site if you dig around. I'll put a link in our post.
And I'll put it in the show notes too.
Yeah,
whatever you're about to say,
I did a top 10 Pixar scenes ever.
Oh,
and of
boy.
Course, Up is in there. that montage.
I don't know that, like, and again, we're getting off topic, but I don't know that I'll ever forget seeing that movie in the theater.
No.
Going, like, we're doing what right now? Like,
yeah.
What is happening right now?
Yeah.
I'm not mentally prepared for this.
And that's
whole,
all, that's like early in the first act kind of thing. Rips
it's the first,
your heart
like, 4
out.
Minutes.
Rips
like,
your heart out. But, you know, even this, even Finding Dory has a, it didn't, you know, like on it was like a 7 on the Pixar scale of weepiness, you know.
Yep.
I did, you know, every time I watch WALL-E, I get teary. Every time I watch Toy Story 3, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, and then up is the 10, it pegs the top. It's the 10 Kleenex movie. I couldn't look up that clip online, and you you check it to make sure it's the actual clip, and you're looking at it, and you get caught up in it, and next thing you know, I've got something in my
yes.
eye. It's just a little cat dander.
Yeah, it's a cat dander. Yes, that's what it is. It's just a little cat dander.
But there's a scene where Dory's parents, who are voiced by Diane Keaton and Eugene Levy, by the way, are like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? What if she gets lost? And she gets lost. And that's just a horrible, heartbreaking thing. And the way things come together, and I'm not going to spoil it for anybody, is really quite moving. It's remarkably moving how Dory finds Dory.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
You know, and I read another review where someone commented, this really should be titled, more accurately, this would be titled Marlin and Nemo Help Dory Find Her Parents. It's like, no. This is about Dory finding herself. Of course it's going to be called Finding Dory. And it's not just, you know, the cheap familiarity marketing ploy.
And I would,
same title, different name.
I would say for sure. No, this is a much different, and you'll know this in the first 20 minutes, a much different movie. And I think part of what I was drawn into is, you know, interesting as you're helping me discover myself. I'm finding Eric today, right? You know, it's like what I didn't like about Dory in the first one is what I thought made this one so amazing. Because now you're starting to unpack the onion a little bit and get deeper into, mm-hmm. you know, this tragic backstory. Because for a comedy mechanism, it's funny in small doses, right? Mm-hmm. But when you unpack it and it becomes the problem in the movie, it becomes horrifically tragic, especially when you start off with a baby fish doing it. Right.
Oh,
now
yeah.
You're like, okay, I can't. Okay.
Oh yeah. I mean, that.
How much more money do you want? Like, okay, you've got
the,
me.
The opening shot, tiny baby Dory, giant eyes.
Yes.
It's like, There was as soon as that came on the theater I was in, it just like you could hear that reaction.
Yep.
You don't get that reaction in very many movies anymore, I've noticed. You know, people are they see a lot of media and they don't react like they used to. And granted, this is a little different. Younger audiences tend to be a little more vocal. They're a little less reserved, a little less cynical about things. But there was that, like, oh, look at baby Dory. and it immediately hooks you. You know, it's not just a cheap ploy to sell baby Dory dolls.
Sure.
Which,
well,
I'm sure
it did. Yeah. Sure. But the screening I was working was mostly employees from a grocery chain. Yeah, there were some kids in there, but it was adults blubbering like schoolgirls in this thing.
There is a degree of poetry to this, too, that it didn't hit me at first blush. I mean, I walked out of the movie and thought, you know, that was pretty good. I don't know if I like it as much as Finding Nemo. And Finding Nemo had a similar impact on me where I thought, you know, that's really good. It's a lot of fun. It's a sweet story. But, like, the other stuff didn't hit me until someone pointed out, have you thought about what Dory says all the time? Just keep swimming. You know, and it's like, I hate to be, I'm someone who overthinks and uses a lot of words. And when someone is too reductionist, I tend to be like, oh, shut up. You know, life isn't that simple. Just Keep Swimming is a very inspiring three words.
Yep.
Because how many times did you think it when you're, I don't know, running a marathon or giving birth? I mean, frankly, think about it. I mean, you are facing some kind of hardship, and whatever you're facing probably isn't as difficult as what Finding Dory is facing in this, Dory is facing in Finding Dory.
Well, and on another level, her ability to just trust the system, so to speak, right? Like she doesn't know what she's just going to do. She's doing this thing. I'm going on an adventure. I need to go to this place. And I trust that the thing that I'm going there for is going to be there. And if not, we'll start all over again. Right.
Well, but she doesn't see a choice. That's the difference. You know, Marlon is like, "What? You just stay here. We're good. We have our own little family." You know, that's the implication. But she doesn't know who she is. You know, it's her identity quest. And this is like a great thing to see in children's films. This is why I love the Kung Fu Panda movies, because they're identity quests.
Yep.
For Po. Sure, Skadoosh, he eats a lot. He falls down. He's roly-poly. There's funny characters. But these are about these characters finding themselves. They aren't just on adventures for the sake of having an adventure, you know. There's the external and the internal journeys to be had here. One of my favorite like bits of symbolism is the view. You know, Marlon and Dory look at the view. It's at the drop off of the reef where they live, and it's a big, wide open, beautiful, scary thing. And Dory has no question about going out there and finding herself. And I thought that was just a wonderful kind of bit of symbolism there, where it's this big, wide open space, and how are you going to fill that space? And she fills it with hope. And it's such a bright, enlightening. I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it, because it's so profound at times, you know, and profoundly understated. It's just, you know, what are you doing? I'm just looking at the view, Marlon, you know. And it's a beautiful way to, you know, show to have a nice quiet moment after a very busy movie where there are a lot of big laughs too, mind you.
Yes.
the Louis Armstrong song "What a Wonderful World" kicks in at a great point in this movie, where things get really silly and fun. Get to the point. This isn't just a bunch of heavy duty stuff, you know. One of the complaints I heard about WALL-E when it came out, and I walked out of that movie, I'm like, this is a masterpiece. This is 8 years from now, I'm still going to be talking about WALL-E. I'm talking about WALL-E
yep.
8 years from now. Yeah. Like a top 10 movie for me ever. And one of the things that other people had said to me was, you loved WALL-E so much. And I took my kids and they were just like, they didn't care. You know, and WALL-E has a more heady quality to it, you know. It's hard to sell kids on a movie that... sell certain younger audiences on a movie that doesn't have any dialogue
yes,
for 30 minutes.
And, yeah, and
but on the other hand, kids are also more open than you and I are. They you know, they've had less experiences. Maybe they've only watched 100 movies. An 8-year-old has only watched 100 movies, and 99 of them had a lot of dialogue in it. Where am I going with this? WALL-E was probably a touch less crowd friendly. I think that's where it became real. It almost hard art at times. Even though this is about a funny little robot and he makes cute noises and all that stuff, you know. But I think that's where WALL-E is like the peak of Pixar art. And Finding Dory, it isn't there. There's a lot of crowd-pleasing stuff in this. When I went to Disney World 4 years ago, I scoured. We spent a few days there. We went to all four major parks. I scoured gift shops. I found one Wall-E thing. One.
Wow.
I counted them. One, because I bought it. It was a Wall-E Christmas ornament. I went there thinking, you know what? I'm gonna get some cool Wall-E stuff. I'm gonna pay too much money for this cool Wall-E stuff that I can't get anywhere else. And I found a Christmas ornament. That's what you know, that's the remarkable thing about finding Dory, to bring this all full circle, is that it has a huge audience, had a built-in huge audience. It's only going to get bigger. It's only going to get bigger, and it has something to say. This isn't Jurassic World, where people are going for the spectacle. You know, this isn't yet another Marvel movie, where people are going because they need to go to keep up with
to finish their Marvel degree.
You know, is there a degree in Marvel?
I mean,
studies?
I feel like if you had to watch all 52 of them when it's all done in 2028, like I feel like you should get something. You get something for taking classes on Facebook. Why can't I get a, you know, why can't I get a degree for going to all these
Just
Marvel
at
movies?
At least a certificate, a little ceremony, something, you know.
I want a master's
in back.
Armored raccooning. I don't know.
Finding Dory, great movie. Where would I rank it in the Pixar canon? I don't know. It's probably a top 10.
Sure. I mean, granted, yeah, I don't know.
There's only, what, 19, 17 films? I forget now.
Really? There's only that many? It feels like there's a lot more.
Well,
than that.
Toy Story came out.
You don't have to like go through all of them.
Toy Story came out in 95, so they've been making movies for 20 years. I think it's slightly less than one a year. I tend to, well, I mean, it's not as good as Wall-E, Toy Story 3,
yep.
Toy Story 2.
So now we're down to number 5. Would you, okay, so at this point, I mean, I know you're only sort of removed from it, and maybe next week would be a different answer.
Yeah.
Would you rank it above Finding Nemo or below Finding Nemo?
I think it's like, for different reasons, I think it's, they are pretty much equals in my mind, you know, because Finding Nemo was a huge, like, groundbreaking moment in animation, and this takes it a step further because it has to in the art of storytelling. So
they'll be tied for 5 then?
I don't know.
I'm gonna pin you down on that. Tied for 5.
Pin me down. Well, give me a list of all the Pixar movies off the top of your head. Go. Good Dinosaur's fairly low.
Really?
The Cars movies are fairly low. Good Dinosaur looks great. I think the story is pretty rote. I'm
okay.
Did you know? Here's your trivia. The Good Dinosaur was the only Pixar film to be a financial failure.
Wow.
Yes, they invested I don't know, between $400 and $500 million in that movie. Between production costs and advertising and marketing, and did it even do $200 or $300 million worldwide? I mean, it performed quite poorly. And you have to wonder, is 2 Pixar movies in 1 year too much? You know, cause they released
within 12
2.
Months. Yeah.
Yeah. They released 2. I think there's plenty of space out there for people to go buy tickets. I just think the word of mouth on The Good Dinosaur was not great. And it's not a great movie. I think it looks great. I think there's some fun parts in it. It's better than a good majority of other animated films.
Yes, without a doubt.
But we're judging it in the Pixar world.
Here's your list. There's been 17 since 1995. You have Toy Story, A Bug's Life, Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, The Incredibles, Cars, Ratatouille, Wall-E, Up, Toy Story 3, Cars 2, Brave, Monsters University, Inside Out, Good Dinosaur, Finding Dory. And then coming up, you have Cars 3, Coco, Toy Story 4, and Incredibles 2, all between now and 2019.
Yeah. Inside Out, Incredibles are top 5 for me, which bumps Nemo and Dory down.
Tied for 6 or perhaps 7.
You know, they're almost Ratatouille. Ratatouille, I think, is one of the most underrated Pixar films.
Yeah.
That is a work of art as well.
But again, that might be too heady storytelling.
You well, know, yeah,
like if you're
for
not
sure.
a food nerd, I don't think all of that stuff kind of launches you into like, this is an amazing way to tell
a story. Well, in kids and families who are going to see movies for whatever reasons they see movies, outings, you know, escapism, whatever. They're not sitting there going, oh my gosh, look at the way Brad Bird directed this sequence where
right.
where Remy the Rat runs through the ceiling tiles and climbs up and down the pipes and stands on the roof and looks at a gorgeous twilight shot of the Eiffel Tower. they're not noticing things like that. They're going to the movies for different reasons. Not that there's anything wrong with that. but yeah, I don't know where I would put Dory at this point. I've seen every other Pixar movie at least two or three times. I would probably have to see Dory another once or twice before I could really, really cement it. See if it holds up. See if it holds up on a second viewing. See if it holds up a few years.
You even watched Monsters University more than one time? Really?
No. Well,
because of this list, that's probably the last on my list. Maybe
I haven't seen Cars 2 more than once. Cars 2 was awful. That is the absolute bottom for me. Since we have a kid, we've kind of half watched things
like
Monsters U and
I've probably
and The Good Dinosaur.
I've probably seen Up because she went through that phase. I've probably seen Up 100 or 200 times. I've seen Inside Out well into the hundreds. And then I've seen what else? She was into Monsters Inc. for a minute. Did not get into The Incredibles, so I tried to adopt her out. So, but that didn't work. So,
The Incredibles, one of the best action films of the new millennium.
It is so good.
In my mind, Bourne Ultimatum, best action movie of the millennium. Number two, The Incredibles. Not a joke. Not joking. That scene where Dash runs over the water, that is amazing. That whole sequence.
No, the whole movie is amazing. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And you know what? Superheroes, not based on anything but themselves. Thank you.
And I may or may not call my son Jack-Jack. That may be a thing. I don't know.
Or Element Boy. Do you call him Element Boy?
He doesn't quite respond. At 6 months old, not responding to Element Boy. Turns out that's above his head a little bit.
Yeah, well. Sooner or later, that's going to happen.
Yes.
I did, however, rank the top five Pixar characters. Dory, number two.
Who's number one?
Wall-E, dude. Totally. Wall-E.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, but I mean, you look at me like I asked the craziest question ever, and that, I mean, you could think the film is better, but think a character in a different film was more impactful.
Sure.
So don't look at me like I'm insane. That was like the worst look I've had in...
Well, I don't know. I've championed Wall-E so loudly for a long time. I just assume those people walking outside our window here know that I would pick Wall-E number one. So that's just my ego talking.
Okay.
Now, let's shift gears a little bit. Let's not like things for a second.
And now, John Serba hates your favorite movie. If you smell
what John Serba's cooking. If Central Intelligence is your favorite movie, I kind of hate your favorite movie.
I didn't loathe this.
I really didn't loathe it. And in fact, I took so much crap a year ago. What the Rock movie was it? San Andreas
would have been last year, yeah.
Yeah, where I made a list of like the top seven stupidest movies The Rock has ever been in. I mean, and it took some carving down because he's been in a lot of stupid movies. The comment I put in my San Andreas review was like, I'm only going to refer to his character as The Rock because when The Rock is in a movie, the only thing he plays is The Rock. Well, Central Intelligence, frankly, deviates from that.
Oh, boy.
It does. Like, you can actually sense The Rock and Kevin Hart. Kevin Hart's a very talented guy. You can sense them putting in a lot of effort for no discernible reason. I mean, they are working with a complete rubbish screenplay. I mean, it is almost the same story as the movie I hated a couple weeks ago on this here podcast, The Do-Over.
Really?
It's a class reunion story. Two guys who knew each other in high school reuniting. One's cool, one isn't. You know. And they have this like ridiculous adventure. And it's and you don't really know the nature of the Adam Sandler character, and it's the same with the Rock character here, who might or might be a CIA agent, or he might be a good one or a rogue one, or he might just be a crook, and you can't tell. It just depends on what idiotic joke they want to tell. That's it just depends. I saw this. It's Monday. We're recording this on a Monday. I saw this on a movie on a Thursday. So we're going on 3.5 days removed from it. I can't remember anything about it. I'm sitting here trying to come up with the plot. Kevin Hart's character was like the superstar in high school. They called him the Golden Jet. It's all coming back to me now. It's all coming back to me. They called him the Golden Jet. I mean, he was everybody. He was the class hero. He was the class president. He was voted most likely to succeed. 20 years later, he's an accountant, which is the go-to boring job that Hollywood screenwriters come up with, besides writing movies like this, because that sounds like an even more boring job.
Yeah, I feel like
in a faceless cubicle.
Well, and they, you know, I feel like they do two things, right? You're either an accountant, or if it's some sort of environmental destruction movie, right? You're a divorcee and your kids are with your wife, and you have to save your kids and your wife, and then in the end you get remarried. Like, that feels like it's the easiest way to write a screenplay in Hollywood, is like, enter earthquake, tsunami, mass freeze, Godzilla, whatever.
Yeah.
And then Dwayne The Rock Johnson is on this side, and wife number one is on this side, and she happens to have the kids for the weekend, that the earthquake shows up.
Have you taught a screenwriting class?
I feel I could. Like, if we're just going to do action movies, we can do, okay, so your best friend used to be the quarterback. Now he's an accountant. You are a helicopter pilot who's divorced, and your kids are with your wife, and there's a giant lizard destroying your hometown.
Oh, did you watch The People versus O.J. Simpson?
No, I have
on
not.
On FX?
No.
Remarkable drama, by the way.
No, it's, I hear it's great things.
Yeah, it's great. My favorite joke, there's a very small character in this who is a screenwriter. And she teaches a screenwriting class, but she's never sold a screenplay. And the question is, you know, you have a bunch of lawyers sitting there, and they get off on a tangent about how does she teach a screenwriting class? She's never sold a screenplay. That is Hollywood in a nutshell.
Because yes.
I know people who have made a remarkable living in Hollywood, you know, doing, I don't know what they do. They write things that never get made.
And really, you know, to tie this all back into what you make fun of me about, this is no different than the world of entrepreneuring and marketing. There's plenty of people that are selling $800 ebooks that have never worked at a place or had a successful business.
Yeah.
But some idiot's giving them $800 to download their ebook, tell them to start a Twitter account or whatever, you know.
Can you get me into this racket?
Yeah, why not?
I need a side gig.
I mean, I certainly think that you and I should start writing Dwayne The Rock Johnson crazy action movies.
So,
hey, Dwayne, have you done a super volcano? Because we think, like, your wife could work in Yellowstone, and you guys were high school sweethearts, and then something fell apart, and your kids are going camping with her for the weekend because they're going to see grizzly bears, and then there's a super volcano, and you happen to be an accountant.
Well, no, it can't be a super volcano. We've seen that before.
Has he been in a super volcano? Because I feel like he needs to do all of them. Like,
I don't know. There might have. Did a volcano pop up in San Andreas?
I don't know. You act as if I finished watching that movie.
I finished watching it. You know,
let me guess. Do they get married at the end? I bet they get married.
Well, they do get back.
Okay, of course
they
do. See, I don't need to.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry.
Spoiler alert.
From 18 months ago, if you haven't watched the 15 movies that came out last year.
Well, I mean, her new boyfriend, you know, lost his erection. His giant skyscraper got toppled in the earthquake. He's now impotent. She's got to go back to the rock. He can fly around and rescue people.
It feels like there's like a concrete Cialis joke
there's
in there.
There's a lot of phallic imagery.
I'm going to leave it alone.
Happening there.
I'm going to leave that alone.
As I probably should have, too.
That's okay. It's your
but
show.
The Rock has been in some stupid stuff. And San Andreas, I have to divert one more time. My favorite line in San Andreas, he and his wife are walking, and she looks at something, and she goes, "What is that?" And he goes, "That's the San Andreas Fault." Someone got paid a lot of money to write that. You know that? A lot. Way more money than you and I have seen. Anyway.
Wayne, have you been in a shipwreck movie?
Is there some kind of... What kind
you and your
of
wife could be divorced, but you're on a cruise line of divorcees that are trying to get back together, and the boat snaps in half, and your kids and your wife are on one half, and you're
No. He's a devoted career man.
I like
who,
it.
Who meets up with a little orphan girl.
Okay, here we go.
Who believes he is the Easter Bunny, because he's done the Tooth Fairy already.
Okay. So this is Finding Annie?
Sure.
Okay.
Because I'm trying to think of him having to wear some kind of embarrassing costume in a kid's movie.
Perfect.
So it's the Easter Bunny. Okay. It's the Easter Bunny. Anyway, in Central Intelligence...
Does it matter at this point?
Does it matter? It doesn't matter
this
at all.
The last 10 minutes were the best 10 minutes of your day, my friend who's ever listening to this. So what does it matter what he actually thinks about Central Intelligence?
The movie actually was reasonably popular, more popular than expected.
34 million,
yeah,
right?
Well, Kevin Hart is a superstar right now, you know. I saw his stand-up comedy a year ago, and he's really funny. He's really good at what he does. But you don't want to make the like crass comparison, but don't be Eddie Murphy, dude. You know, do something that's worthy of your talents.
Well, yeah, because I was going to say, like, when you watch Ride Along, I think, like, the comedy beats in Ride Along seem like those two have some sort of say in it, where I haven't seen this yet, but it feels like they just read whatever somebody told them to say. And
no,
then...
I honestly haven't seen the Ride Along films. The last Kevin Hart movie I saw was the one he did with Will Ferrell. What was that called?
Get Hard.
Get Hard. Yeah, that was terrible. Yeah, yeah, the theme we're avoiding. The one thing I liked about Central Intelligence was the fact that The Rock, in high school, he was the overweight kid. He was mortified by bullies, thrown into the gymnasium naked while there was a big pep rally happening. And so, you know, of course, what does the cliche dictate? The cliche dictates that 20 years later, he looks like The Rock.
Yes, right.
You know? And how does he explain it? What have you been doing? I've been working out 6 hours a day for 20 years. That's a joke a screenwriter wrote.
Yes.
You know, that's a joke.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. It just wasn't funny, so I wasn't going to...
Yeah, yeah, we're laughing pretty hard over here. So, you know, they reconnect of course, there's a scene in the bar where there's a jerk in the bar and he, you know, kicks their asses, and everything is just a kind of rote going through the motions thing. And it doesn't really exploit the fact that, you know, one of the things Kevin Hart does really well, he can be this kind of outwardly bragging type, but inwardly cowardly. And one of the great... extended bits of his stand-up comedy that I enjoyed was how he was scared one night taking out the trash because it was really dark. And I thought that was really funny because here's this guy on stage who looks like he's, you know, he's dressed in leather like Eddie Murphy in 1984. He's bulletproof up there, and he's up there making fun of himself, which is a really remarkable thing. So he can have that little... that subtext to what he does, but you know the it's the writing that fails him. And The Rock here, he has this grin on his face the whole time, where you don't know, is this guy just upbeat or is he psychotic? You know, but you know it's just a bunch of wacky trash. It really is. I didn't think it was that funny. There were about 8 other people in the theater when I saw it, and I didn't hear a whole lot of laughter coming out of them either. And they were, you know, hooting at movie trailers beforehand, before the movie started. So, I don't know. There's an audience out there for it. I think it's just Kevin Hart fans going out to see what Kevin Hart does because it's a Kevin Hart thing.
Do you think, well, I mean, likely it'll plummet this week, right?
Yeah, most likely. Most likely. I'm sure it will.
All right,
that's
then.
That's all I have to say about Central
all
Intelligence.
All right, then.
I mean, you know, obviously the title is put out there as a kind of ironic thing. It's certainly ironic. What should we talk about in our next episode?
I don't know. I would defer to the master.
Isn't it Independence Day, colon?
Oh, it is. I can't even wait.
Resedemption. Is there a colon in the title? I think there's a colon.
There is a colon in the title.
We will also be talking about, and this is one I am very fired up to see, The Neon Demon. Do you know what The Neon Demon is?
I do not.
It is a new film from director Nicholas Winding Refn. Do you remember what he directed? Drive.
Yes.
One of my favorite movies, and he's got a new one out. It's a horror film, and it's... I don't even know anything about it. I see it tomorrow. and that's by design. Let it surprise me. So we'll talk about that. Maybe if I have time, I'll get out and see Free State of Jones starring Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, that looks
good. And we can throw that in as well. Thanks for listening. This has been I Hate Your Favorite Movie.